Log of the Red Ship on Carmine, Captain Philippe Larue commanding. Dreamland, Southern Seas of the Isle of Oriap. 501st year, 21st day, 3 hours past noon. Around mid-afternoon, the mortals returned from their reconnaissance in Baharna, accompanied by another kine, a veiled healer by the name of Summers. A council of war was called with the following in attendance: myself, Monsieur Pierce, Monsieur Wilmot, Monsieur Frost, Monsieur Bradley, et la Dame Bethany, Sir Royston and his lapdog, June. Pierce seemed ill at ease, complaining about an upset stomach, nausea, and headache. Our healer was puzzled, so I offered the services of Monsieur Dribble. Monsieur Dribble suggested some leeches, perhaps, a nice bloodletting. The occasional displays of humor of Monsieur Dribble never ceased to amaze me. It is not a surprise that Monsieur Pierce decided to suffer en silence. The mortals provided a report on their mission. Their contact in the Temple of Zokalar had showed them a map with a secret route onto the summit of the mountain. A gate lies within a cave there that can send you to the deserted silent city, said to be guarded by spirits in the midst of ruins infested with wasps and giant spiders. But the portal, once activated, can take a party to the mountain. A discussion ensued between Sir Royston and the mortals. A tentative plan was reached between the mortals and Sir Royston. As the silent city was about a day's march from the cove indicated by the mortals' source, the mortals would march on ahead, with the kindred following at night using all possible haste. In this manner, they could enter the silent city together as a combined force. I chose to use the word combined, not the word united, as I am not certain that would be accurate. As the plan was agreed, Monsieur Pierce seemed oddly subdued and starting to look paler by the minute. La Dame Bethany seemed nervous, agitated. 501st year, day 21, 2 hours past sunset. Just after sunset, the lab dog Yune stormed into my cabin with a summons from his ventru home. I rejected his immediate summons and Yuna attacked me. I admit I was taken by surprise. He moved extremely fast and his blade was at my throat. And then he suddenly vanished. I assumed, correctly as it turns out, that she still considers me her first choice as captain. And I went on deck. My crew had already spotted Yuna, a couple of 100 yards off the ship. As he swam back, I went to meet Sir Royston. I learned that the ghoul, Tabitha, and the vessel, Rachel Devereux, had disappeared from the ship. I reached out to her, but she had no hand in this. I can only speculate as to why these two are now gone. The how seems clearer. Such an act seems well within the powers of the Tremere Dame Isabeau, who seems to come and go as she pleases. As I was watching Yunili back on board with murder in his lapdog puppy hound little dog eyes, a surge of panic came over me as she was calling out. At the same time, I heard shouting from the forecastle where the lodgings of the mortals are located. Royston, Yune, myself, and Monsieur Blair rushed down the stairs where we found the mortals facing off against each other. La Dame Bethany, furious in her wrath, was facing Frost, Bradley, and Wilmot. The one they called Rodon the Archer was lying in a heap against the bulkhead. Desig the Black was shouting and trying to calm Bethany down, and through the door of the cabin, I caught a glimpse of Kalk the Pale lying in a heap. As we arrived, Bethany's hands spouted fire and she lurched to the side. Ever was she fearful of fire, and I sensed that she was initiating a submersion. This would have been detrimental to the mortals whom I am duty bound to protect. So I urge her to stay at the surface. But only through supreme effort of Mabruja's will was she convinced. Yuna, Royston, and Poco Loco, who appeared out of nowhere, as always, rushed Bethany, and then she too vanished. I sensed that this time she was not involved. The immediate danger was gone, and we found Rodon the Archer was dead, killed by the magic of La Dame Bethany. Kalk the Pale was badly shaken, but alive, and Desig the Black had literally jumped ship and was swimming to the shore. Kalk judged it inadvisable to try and recover him. He is the Dame Bethany's protector and duty-bound to go where she goes. If his direction is anything to go by, La Dame Bethany has gone to the island. Apparently, she used an ensorcelled device that Monsieur Frost referred to as my box. I thought for a moment that he once called it my precious, but that seems to make no sense at all. The mortals withdrew to their cabin, where they would have thought they were discussing matters in private, but Mr. Dribble's squeaky little friends were listening, and he mischievously reported back to me. It would seem that La Dame Bethany had become more and more unstable, and that she was responsible for the Pierce's ill health. It would seem, and I freely admit that my understanding of these issues is limited, that Pierce made a note in his log. In this note, he surmised that La Dame Bethany was afflicted with something called PMS, which La Dame Bethany, being a mind reader, took exception to. She then proceeded to inflict this PMS on the Pierce. I am not quite certain what this PMS might be, but La Dame Bethany seems to have un sens ironique of justice. It also seems that there is a measure of distrust between the Pierce on the one hand and his cohorts on the other. It would be exceedingly useful to have access to this logbook of his. Perhaps Monsieur Dribble will be able to oblige. Worried by this act, Kalk the Pale had told Pierce's companions about her actions. In turn, La Dame Bethany, being a mind reader, lest we forget, discovered his treason, his trahison, and she exacted punishment. While La Dame Bethany has proven an asset, and where she might have been useful to counterbalance Sir Royston and his escorts, her instability has now turned her into a liability, and now she is also a danger to her. Although she will be missed, under the present circumstances, we are better for her absence.
Day 29, Subjective, in the Dreamlands. I once heard a story about Rahm Emanuel, the guy who's been tapped as new chief of staff to our commander-in-chief-elect, about how, after Clinton's election in 1992, he was having a steak dinner with the other staffers, and all of a sudden he starts rattling off the names of all people who tried to fuck Clinton, in the metaphorical sense. Monica Lewinsky was only a distant stain in the future. Slamming his knife into the table after each name and shouting, "Dead!" And then everyone joined in. Must have been quite a scene. You know, I could probably do the same thing for those on our side. Winchester, dead. Kruger, dead. Martikian, dead. Parisi, dead. Summers, brain dead, but hey, still walking. Derek, dead. Walker, dead. And let's face it, I'm not feeling too dandy either. But I'm getting ahead of myself. We lost Walker, or Kalk, as he was known here in the jungle. We disembarked, D-Day it was not, and set off into the jungle, skirting the edge of a great lake. It was going to take us about 2 days marching to reach the Silent City. The Bloodsuckers would catch up with us during the second night, and we'd enter the Sun City together. We cleared the lake, and we were following a jungle trail with Wilmot on point, and Worker behind, Summers in the middle, Chief watching her back. If it had been Wilmot, he'd probably be watching her ass. Frost watching his, not on purpose perhaps, but it's kind of hard to miss, and me bringing up the rear. We took a break while Wilmot was scouting ahead. The Leatherneck and him was probably enjoying this in a way. Life had suddenly become a bit more simple. We wanted to catch our breath, but we caught something else instead. The attention of a pack of monkeys. He swarmed over us, getting everywhere. One of them tried to get my boot. So I gave him the boot, all right. 30 yards at least. A 3-point field goal, if ever I saw one. Then I turned around, and Walker had collapsed. A cracked coconut was lying next to him, and a trickle of blood was coming from his scalp. Chief and Summers examined him, and the verdict was harsh. He was dead. The coconut killed him. But Firth had had just as much to do with it or more. Their altercation, their fight, had left him with a cracked skull, and a monkey dropping a coconut had cracked it open. Shit. Exit 13, numero duo. Does that now make them 11? Anyway, we crossed the river, continued our slog through the boonies, when Kakovsky appeared out of nowhere. Really, like, out of fucking nowhere. I mean, I had my eyes peeled, but I never saw him coming. He brought good news. He had spied in the native's village. Cannibal pygmies with sharpened teeth, who were chummy with the Iron Army. They managed to summon 3 dark young of Shub-Niggurath, and they were on the march. So you may ask, how is that good news? Well, they're not after us. They have probably cut off our avenue of retreat, though. Chances are they'll go through the foraging party like triple hot chili taco through a Norwegian tourist digestive system. Fast and nasty. We continued the march of fools and held another break. And then we were there, at the edge of the Sun City. The Sun City is a place deserted of life, like, what was that old ship story, the Mary Celeste, just as if one moment life was there and the next it was gone. The city itself is surrounded by a ring of dead land, around 100 meters across, the soil turned to ash and littered with skeletal bits. This did not seem to bode well. And somehow we had covered half of the distance between the cove and the Sun City in just under an hour. There had been some event, something happened. It must have been magic. Please note how smooth and natural that thought seems to flow now. As for crossing the Ring of Death, it's possible to risk it and just walk across, if you're lucky. I did step onto the soil. It was an experience unlike anything else. Just imagine being thrown into sub-freezing water with a concrete block tied to your legs and arms in complete darkness. You're shaking uncontrollably. The water is crushing your head like a metal press. You have no idea which way is up, but you try to swim. But you have no idea if you're heading towards the surface or towards the bottom. And then you feel piranhas nibbling at your ass. That's what it was like. A couple of times, it's almost like I reached the surface only to sink again, running out of breath. A red veil passed before my eyes, and the pain in my head became unbearable. And then, I was through. In an instant, I crossed the Ring of Death. Frost came next. He made it through, barely. He was shaking harder than a cocktail waiter with a Parkinson's disease. We then proceeded with what should have been done in the first place, rigorous scientific research. Small animals died when they crossed the ring. whether walking, or being pushed if you want to be technical about it, or flying, as in being thrown. Dead leaves were not affected. So it was theorized that dead materials were not affected, but only to the extent that the ambient death field could not touch any living flesh. As it turns out, between them, Chief, who probably paid more attention during theoretical physics colleges than during practical medicine courses, and Summers, theorized that by passing through, our life and death phasing had shifted polarity, and that it should be possible for one who has already passed to pass again. I tried. It worked. At this point, Frost revealed a hitherto hidden talent, the ability to create a portal circle. You know, a gate. I remember Brooks talking about such things, and I knew that creating one of these circles drains the very life out of you. But Frost went ahead anyway to get the rest of the group across safely. You know, I'll give it to him. That kid sure got balls.